It's so important for us to speak about how to date, how to get married, because it's something that our educational system has really abandoned, something that they've ignored. In the high school textbooks, the little bit of information we get about dating and marriage is all about how to stay physically healthy during dating and marriage. You'll find a lot of material about venereal disease and how to avoid it, but not necessarily information about how to make a relationship go click. The people who teach those courses, they're usually gym teachers who are saddled with one extra responsibility, don't really know anything about relationships. And all the information they can give over is what's in the text, which is skeletal at best. So it's very, very important for people to seek out expert advice. I found that these Orthodox Jews, they have an unusual definition of love. And their definition of love completely alters their definition of marriage, meaning that their definition of love and marriage is not like our mainstream Western definition of love and marriage. I'll explain. There's a Hebrew word which is often translated as love. It is the Hebrew word for love. But I don't think it means the same thing that we in the West mean when we say love. The Hebrew word is ahava. Ahava is the word hav conjugated. Hav means to give. Ahav is I will give. Ahava is the state of I will giveness. That is, according to these Jews, love is a state that someone goes into wherein all they want to do is take care of and give to a partner. Now, right away, you can start to see the difference between what we mean by love and what these Orthodox Jews mean by love. If I walk up to one of my college students and I ask a woman, you know, do you love him? So she's an intelligent person. She'll stop and she'll think and she'll have to ask herself some questions. She'll say, well, you know, what does he do for me? What does he make me feel like? How good do I feel when I'm with him? How much does he do for me? How proud am I to be standing next to him? All the questions she's going to ask herself are questions about me, I. When I want to know if I'm in love from a secular Western perspective, the real question I'm asking is, how much pleasure am I deriving? How much selfish pleasure am I deriving from the relationship? And if I derive enough, then I cross this threshold called love. But if you pull aside one of these Orthodox Jews and you ask them, do you love her? So he has to stop and ask himself a completely different set of questions. He has to ask himself, how much am I willing to let go of what I want for her sake? How much am I willing to sacrifice for the sake of my beloved? What am I willing to let go of for her? It's all about her. It's all about the other. Ahava, I will give. If I want to know if I'm in love, if I'm in ahava from a Jewish perspective, so then the whole question is, how much am I willing to let go of for the sake of the other? Now, if the definitions of love in our culture versus this Orthodox Jewish culture are diametrically opposed, expectedly that would lead to drastic differences in the definition of marriage, and it does. The word marriage, if you look it up in the Fine Dictionary, you'll find that it means a merger of two or more corporate entities. It's a business arrangement. We talk all the time about how the key in marriage is compromise. 50-50 deal. I'll do for you, you do for me. I'll take out the trash. You do the dishes. I'll earn the money. You take care of the kids. And it's a great marriage as long as we're both compromising. We're both doing our half of the deal, like any good corporate arrangement. But of course, if I refuse to do my half of the deal, so you'll legitimately say, hey, this is not fair. I'm doing the dishes. Why don't you take out the trash? I'm earning the money. Why aren't you taking care of the kids? And in fact, because marriage is a corporate arrangement, so divorce is not uncommon, because the marriage is only viable as long as both parties are doing their share. The Jewish perspective is different. Those Orthodox Jews, they believe that the model of a perfect spouse is God. They have this wild belief that human beings were created in the image of God. And because they're created in the image of God, they have God-like potential. And therefore, at least in terms of character, they could become like God. Now, if you add to this that they believe that God is pure ahava, he's pure giving, all he wants to do is take care of. In fact, that's why he created the whole universe, so there would be someone to care for, someone to give to. That's what they believe. Then he is the model spouse. He just gives and gives and gives, and he really doesn't want anything back. All he wants is our welfare, what's good for us. So for these Orthodox Jews, marriage is not a 50-50 deal. And in fact, they don't even have the word marriage in their vocabulary. The word they use is a Hebrew word, nisuin. Nisuin is the plural of the word carry. Their word for marriage is carryings. One of their rabbis once explained to me, why do we call marriage carryings? He said, because on the day of the wedding, you step underneath the marriage canopy, you pick up your spouse, and you say, I won't put her down no matter how heavy she gets. The idea is that I'm getting married because I'm so full of love, that is, I'm so full of Ahava, that is, I'm so full of the need to give, that I want to take full-time responsibility for somebody else for the rest of their life. I want to care for them in every single way. When a person has a desire to care for somebody else, to take care of them, then it's time to start looking for a partner who they could take care of. How do we know when we're ready to get married? So the first index, the first measure of traditional Jewish maturity would be, how much have I gotten out of myself, and am I capable of focusing on others and their needs? These Orthodox Jews, it's interesting, they divide human character development up into a continuum that basically breaks into four stages, but it's a continuum. There are those people at the very, very bottom of the continuum who are 100% takers, completely selfish. Most of people who are at that level, so they're interested in 50-50 arrangements, compromise. I'll do the dishes, you take out the trash, that sort of relationship. Now, why are they interested in a 50-50 relationship if they're 100% taker? So the answer is because they're smart. And if you're a real smart taker, you realize it's better not to take 100% and not give anything back, because you're going to get dumped. No one's going to want to spend time with you. You see this in the business world. Someone who just wants to take money, so they don't become a bank robber unless they're a fool. Because if you're a bank robber, how long are you going to get away with it? A month, 2 months, a year, 5 years? After 5 years, you're going to end up in jail. You'll have to stop taking. Someone who really wants to take and is highly intelligent, they'll go into business, open a supermarket. Then people come and bring them their money every day, and they can stay in business for a lifetime. And more than that, the people compliment them on their wonderful service and the high-quality products, and the market is able to take and take and take. It's not to say all businessmen are only takers. We're not saying such a thing. Obviously, that's not true. There are very good people who are involved in business. But if someone were to be a 100% taker, certainly the intelligent thing to do is go into business, make a 50-50 deal. And that's what we see in relationships. At the bottom of the continuum, what those Orthodox Jews call level four, is someone who is 100% taker and therefore is willing to stay in a marriage as long as they're getting a benefit out of it. The next step up on the continuum, level three, is someone who, they demand less salary. They don't need their partner to do exactly 50% of the work. The person who's at level three says, you know what? I'll do the dishes and I'll take out the trash. And you know what? I'll earn the money and I'll take care of the kids. I'm willing to do it all. What do I demand in return? I demand a thank you. If I do all that for you and you don't even say thank you to me, so then, I mean, that's just unacceptable. I want a divorce. But as long as number threes get their thank you, then they'll continue to give. Now, you realize number three is a tremendously high level. A very, very rare individual who actually is at level three. Beyond level three, there are people who are at level two. Again, this is a continuum, and I'm just marking off arbitrary detents along this continuum. At level two, the person is willing to take out the trash and do the dishes, and earn the money, and take care of the kids. They're willing to do it all. And they don't even require a thank you. Their salary is even less. The salary that they require is, they want to see that the person who they're taking care of enjoys the services that are being provided. I worked 2 hours on dinner. I want to see that you enjoyed it. But if I work 2 hours on dinner, and I put it down in front of you, you don't have to say thank you, but if I put it down in front of you, and you say, ugh, this tastes terrible, and you push it off the table, then I'm not going to make you dinner anymore. I don't want you to say thank you to me, but at least you should enjoy the things that I give you. That's the salary that I require back at level two. The satisfaction of knowing that you enjoyed my services. Now, there is a level beyond level two. This is what these Orthodox Jews call a divine level, the level of God himself. And at that level, I don't need you to do 50% of the work, and I don't need you to say thank you, and I don't even need to see that you enjoyed it. These Orthodox Jews, they believe that God showers people with kindness, and very often, the people are completely disappointed with the kindnesses that God provides. They wanted something which was not good for them. And they don't show a lot of satisfaction in the gifts that they received, if they notice them at all. And yet, God continues to give and give and give. That's the highest level, is I don't even need to see that you enjoyed what I provided. And even if you reject the beautiful gifts that I give, I'll continue to give them forever. That's the ideal. that's not something that can be achieved certainly in the first 5 or 10 or even 20 years of marriage. And it could only be achieved by someone who's working very, 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 very hard on himself or herself for many years. Now, one very important point I should just mention, you cannot fool yourself, pretend you're on a higher level than you are, and then marry someone who is, let's say, emotionally abusive or physically abusive or doesn't provide for your needs. And let's be honest, all of us are going into marriage probably as level 4s. Some people go in as level 5s, bank robbers. But most of us, let's say, are going in as level 4s that we're willing to do a 50-50 deal. And because of that, it's very important that when we go to select a mate, that we select somebody who is nice to us, who does take care of us. Not because that's the goal, but because if we're not realistic, if we don't admit what we need, if we try to fake being on a higher level of refinement than we are, then we could crack. In fact, it's likely that we would crack. What do men specifically need to know before they can get married? So there's a natural feeling that guys have that the best years of their life are coming to a conclusion under the marriage canopy. They're getting tied down. The adventure's over. Guys like to be cowboys. We like to ride around, have a fun time, go on adventures. Now I'm committing to living with a woman for the rest of my life. And that not only limits the sexual adventure that I'll be involved in, but it limits the adventures in all parts of my life. I'm becoming domesticated. I'm going to be taking care of somebody forever. And that's frightening. What we men have to realize, though, is that getting married is the portal to real greatness. We've seen the statistics that the men who are married, they earn higher salaries on average. They live healthier lives on average. They experience higher levels of happiness, job satisfaction, personal satisfaction. So even though it seems that the best days of our lives are passing as we get married, it's an illusion. And the reality is that the best days are just beginning. I mean, just even in terms of one's intimate life, while it's true that single men have far more sexual partners, but married men have sex far more often. So say the statistics. So in all ways, we men have a much better deal after we get married, and therefore, even though there is a certain amount of hesitance, we should know that it's worth moving forward. There's one other major source of hesitance that we men have, and that is there's this feeling that maybe there's somebody better around the corner. And if I just wait, that I'll get somebody better than this girl. Of course, that's a completely destructive attitude, because if that's my attitude, I'll never get married. And each girl that I date, who might be a gem, will eventually give up on me and leave because they realize I won't commit. Ultimately, I end up living alone. And that's not a life. So one of the most important things for women to know is that while in the old days, it was common that a man and a woman from the same village would marry, and they basically knew who the other was almost even before they met because they were coming from such similar backgrounds. So today, that's not the case. We come from a very broad and rich melting pot. And people have widely varying backgrounds. People have widely varying emotional profiles, spiritual profiles, psychological profiles, intellectual profiles. And you can't count on the person you meet being similar to you in the most essential ways. Therefore, one thing that women must be very careful to do is to date for a more extended period of time. Not to date for a month or 2 months, generally, unless the person's coming from a very similar background, but to stretch it out to make sure that they get to know the person that they're planning on marrying. I don't have to give this advice to men, because men are naturally hesitant anyways. They naturally wait a long time, but women seem to be more sensitive to the value of relationship, and therefore they're more inclined to jump into a relationship a little bit too early. And therefore, it's very important for women to know that they need to get to know their potential spouse very well before they marry him. Some valuable techniques for getting to know a potential spouse, these are things that women can use men as well, is look to see how the person you're dating treats those people that they're not trying to charm. Of course they treat you nicely. They're trying to charm you. But those people who they're not trying to charm, see how your date treats them, the waitress. Look how your date drives the car. It's a great way to get at people's character, because when they get behind the wheel, they let it all hang out. If you watch somebody drive and they're very aggressive on the road, realize that's really who they are. And at times in the relationship, that will come out. You have to be prepared for that. So women need to know who this man is before they marry him. Another thing that both men and women need to know is that they're not looking for a perfect person to marry. Whoever you marry is going to have flaws. The truth is, if you don't see their flaws, you can't marry them, because it means you don't see the person for who they are, because every person has flaws. The question is, are these flaws that you can or should tolerate? If the person is physically abusive or emotionally abusive, this is not a person that you should be dating. But beyond that, everybody has flaws. And if you find that this person is also flawed, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't marry them. This is absolutely the most personal decision that a person ever makes in their life. It's very important that other people don't get involved in pushing you to get married. They think the person is the terrific person for you to marry, but you're not sure. Don't be pressured. That's very important. Not by parents, not by other relatives, not by friends. You have to live for the rest of your life with this person. I cannot tell you how many disasters I've been asked to come in and clean up in cases where the person was hesitant to get married, and the parents or a friend said it would all be okay, and they were wrong. It was not all going to be okay. And the pain that's caused 10, 15, 20 years down the line is just beyond description. Therefore, you have to make the decision. Based on what should you make the decision? So these Orthodox Jews, they have a lot of various criteria for how to pick a spouse, which I think I've boiled down to about four elements. And if we were to take their advice, it seems that if we could find somebody with these four elements, these four characteristics, then it's worth marrying them. Those characteristics are as follows. Number one, the person should be fully committed to some objective moral and ethical standard. Within these Orthodox Jewish circles, they're fully committed to Jewish ethics, the worldview of the Torah, the ethics of the Torah, the lifestyle of the Torah. Now, why is this so important? The reason is because at the center of every human personality, there is this core value, the thing that is most important in the world to that person. And then there are a bunch of satellite values that rotate around that value. Now, if a person's core value, let's say, is adventure, what they most like in the world is adventure. It could be right now this person seems like a very nice person. They're volunteering in a hospice at a hospital. Why? Because for them, this is adventure. It's an exciting thing. They get to help people in the last few moments of life. And to me, it looks like they're really very kind. But the reality is they're not kind. They're just adventurous. And over time, if their core value is adventure, then the way that they pursue that core value or express it might change. They might stop working in the hospital, and they might try other expressions of adventure, which I don't admire as much. In fact, which might even be unpleasant or, in my mind, even unethical. However, if the core of the person is a burning desire to do good, to live a good life, a righteous life, a life of caring, then everything else will rotate around that. And at least I know that for the rest of my life, I'll be married to someone who will take care of me, who will take care of my children, who will be a good person. And of course, if you have to live with somebody for the rest of your life, that's what you want to know, that they're going to be a nice person to live with. So as they say in these Jewish circles, they say the person should be a Ben Torah, meaning that the person should be fully committed to a life of Jewish ethics. So too, I would recommend that all of us learn from their example, and that we make certain that the person that we want to marry, at their core, is committed to goodness. How do you figure that out? It's not very difficult, actually. Whatever a person's core value is, you will find them sacrificing for on a daily basis. So, for instance, if someone's core value is making money, so you, if you follow them for 24, 48, 72 hours, you will see that they will make regular sacrifices for profit to pull in a few more bucks. They'll stay up late, they'll miss out on time with friends, they'll do all sorts of things just to pull them that extra buck. If you hang out with them long enough, you'll see them sacrifice for their core value. If a person's core value is goodness, then if you follow them for 24, 48, 72 hours, you should see them sacrifice for the sake of being kind to somebody else. The waitress got confused and she accidentally brought me the wrong dish for lunch, and I don't want to embarrass her, so I don't say anything. I'll eat this dish. I sacrificed. I wanted the spaghetti. I got the tacos. But as long as my core value is goodness, you'll see me do things like this. You might see someone after work, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, go to volunteer and take care of some kids who aren't as fortunate as them. Maybe they work in a soup kitchen. Follow them. You'll see that they let go of some of their own desires for the sake of taking care of others. That's the number one thing that we look for in a spouse. Number two, we alluded to before, the person who you want to marry should be a person who is going to take care of you, who's going to treat you nicely. And the easiest way to tell how they're going to treat you after they marry you is to see right now how they treat others who they don't care about because they're not trying to charm. So again, the key is to spend time with this person and watch how they treat others that they don't know or don't care about. A telephone operator, do they say thank you? Are they courteous? Do they curse the telephone operator after they hang up the telephone? Again, are they an aggressive driver? Are they rude to the waitress? Do they tip? If they don't tip, that's a sign of stinginess. That's going to come out down the line. All these people who they're not trying to charm, how do they treat them? And most people don't guard themselves so carefully that they would hide how they treat others from you. Usually they'll hide how they're really going to treat you down the line, but they probably don't guard themselves so carefully that you can't tell how they now treat others, and then you'll be able to know how they're going to treat you after you get married. Number one, the person should be considered committed to a higher set of ethics and values. Number two, the person should treat others they're not trying to charm nicely. I call number three good communication. But specifically, what those Orthodox Jews mean is the couple should not constantly get into fights because they misunderstood each other. What does this look like? So the couple's in a fight, you know, and they're arguing, you know, half an hour, 2 hours, sometimes even a day or two. And then it turns out at the end of the fight, oh, it was just a misunderstanding. I thought you meant that. You didn't mean that? Okay, we agree. If the couple is constantly getting into misunderstandings, which then lead to arguments, that's not a good sign because that might not change. It's very difficult for people to change their styles of communication. And therefore, if they're always misunderstanding each other, that's a sign you might want to back off this relationship for a while. So number one, this higher standard of ethics. Number two, a person who's nice to those they're not trying to charm. Number three should be somebody that you communicate with well. And finally, number four, these Orthodox Jews say that the person you marry has to be somebody who you are physically attracted to. It has to be somebody that you wouldn't mind kissing. And that's crucial because the physical is not a small part of a marriage. The physical is a central part. It has to, of course, be an expression of something deep happening emotionally and spiritually, but it cannot be ignored. And therefore, these Orthodox Jews very realistically say that one must be attracted to the person before they marry them. Now, having said that, there's a little difference here between men and women. Generally, men's judgment about looks is more superficial. It's determined really by body type, facial features, etc. And therefore, generally, men within two or three dates make a judgment as to whether or not they are attracted to this person. And often, that judgment doesn't change. Sometimes it does, but often it doesn't. However, ladies are different. A woman could date a man two or three times, and she doesn't necessarily find him repugnant, but she's not necessarily that attracted to him. And that could radically change after two, three, 4 months of dating. So I don't recommend that women break off a relationship with a man if they're not attracted to him immediately. Because as they get to know him better, as they get to know his personality, his dreams, his hopes, etc., very often he actually starts to look physically more attractive to them. The most important pieces of advice that I give to people today in dating is that although they know that they are dating for the sake of marriage, that's why they're going out, is they want to meet someone that they can take care of. But when they're actually out on the date, they have to put that out of their mind. Why? Because otherwise, what constantly runs through my head is, am I selling myself well to this person? I really want them to want to marry me. So am I presenting myself well? And I end up not allowing my personality come out, and I don't let them really get to know me. And the truth is, I don't really get to know them either. Rather, what I recommend is that when people go out, they take on the following attitude. I'll explain it reflecting on my own life. One of the best parts about my job is the spectacular people that I get to meet. I mean, I think that's really what holds me in the job, is that I get to meet such special people. And you know, people are our most precious possessions, so to speak. They're our most precious qualities. So I'm so excited when I have a chance to sit down and talk for an hour with somebody who's lived a life, who's an expert in certain things, who has interesting perspectives, who has completely different intellectual, spiritual, psychological profile than anyone I've ever met before. And I enjoy them. In the exact same way, when you go out on a date, your attitude should be, hey, I've got an hour to spend to meet a person I've never met before. And hear their take on what life is all about and what they find interesting. to experience their sense of humor, to delve into another human being. Put out of your head that this person is going to be deciding if they want to marry you or not. Don't have that in your head. Just think, I'm there to enjoy an interesting human being. That helps everybody relax and makes the dating much more effective. A lot of people are speaking about this today. The sexual component of a relationship is so immensely powerful that it can completely blind us to subtleties in the other person's personality. And therefore, if the sexual component of a relationship is introduced during the dating process, it is extremely likely that both parties are going to miss crucial parts of the other's personality, which might encourage them to marry them or might discourage them from marrying them. Once a woman especially becomes sexually involved with a man, it becomes almost impossible for her to be objective any longer about his personality. She becomes tremendously committed to him. And for that reason, it's especially dangerous for women to become sexually involved. There is an objection that I won't know if I'm physically, sexually compatible with the person unless we actually practice and try things out and see if we are physically, sexually compatible. So the reality is that when two people are completely compatible emotionally, spiritually, intellectually, they love being with each other. So that is the platform on which a healthy, enjoyable physical relationship is built. And ultimately, that is the determinant of how good the physical relationship is, not the size of his muscles or the nature of her technique. One very healthy couple who I once counseled made the comment to me that often they feel the skin gets in the way. So that is a really good sexual relationship. And that's only built on this total emotional commitment. So those people who feel they have to try each other out physically in order to know if it's going to work, they're naive. They don't really understand what makes good sex. They don't understand that the key component is an emotional component. And that requires, from the beginning of the relationship, cultivating deep respect for each other. In dating, there are pitfalls. There's things to avoid. You have to be very, very careful. We mentioned before not to feel pressured to continue to date somebody because a friend or a relative thinks you should. By the same token, it's important not to break off dating with somebody because a friend or relative thinks you should. If this friend or relative cares about us deeply and they articulate an objection, take the objection seriously. File it, think about it, analyze. But ultimately, it has to be you who decides if you want to marry this person or not. Another dating pitfall is, we mentioned before, dating for too short a period of time. And now I'll raise the flip side, people who date for too long. Unfortunately, this is all too common. I saw a tremendous amount of this in my last tour to the United States, especially on the East Coast, especially in New York City, where people would date for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and the most valuable, most precious years of their lives are ticking past, and they're missing out on being married. And then after 2, 3, 4 years, the stress of not being married tears the relationship apart. They break up. Then they have to wait for another to come along, and then they date for another 3 or 4 years, at which point the stress of not being married tears the relationship apart again. So you shouldn't date for too short a time, but you can't date for too long either, because that will destroy the relationship. Let's say you find the person, and they meet all the criteria. You date them. The two of you, in a mature fashion, determine that you do want to be married and live together. A key dating pitfall is to think that you cannot get married until you have established a career or some sort of financial independence. Now, this is just foolish from so many angles. First, it is not cheaper to rent two apartments and live separately. And if you get married, you get a tax deduction. So from a financial perspective, it makes no sense to wait. Beyond that, and this is much more serious, the reason often today that, and I will say, especially women do not like to get married until they have established their academic degree or their career is because they're afraid that if this man abandons them, they won't have a way of supporting themselves. Okay, this is very destructive because the woman is walking into the marriage with a certain degree of hesitance. From day number one, she's not fully committed and she's already planning for what she's going to do if she has to leave. Okay, now I understand why she's doing that with divorce rates as high as they are today. So you could argue it makes sense to take care of yourself. But realize it's a vicious cycle. And if you walk into a relationship and from day one are not fully committed and intending on being with this person forever, then it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that itself will tear the relationship apart. Therefore, I strongly recommend that when the couple has dated long enough, and they know they want to get married to each other, so they should get married. And they should not worry if they have not finished graduate school yet or if their careers are not intact. However they were making it as a single, they will make it as a married couple. If the parents were helping, the parents will continue to help, right? If the parents will not continue to help, then each one will take on a part-time job. They'll rough it out. When my parents got married in the old days, so to speak, there was no concept of being financially well-to-do before you got married. Couples got married. They were starving when they got married. They toughed it out together. That cemented their relationship. So, in a way, these Orthodox Jews are guiding us back towards that very traditional approach that when you're ready to get married, you get married. And the academic degrees you can still pursue. And the financial dependence you can still pursue. But don't wait to live with the one that you love and the one who's going to make your life more meaningful than anything else. Don't wait for that until you've established some sort of financial independence. Another important recommendation for those people who are dating is that you don't pick up a guy or a girl in a bar because you have no idea who you're picking up. And I can't tell you how many broken hearts I've tried to put back together where the damage resulted from someone meeting a total stranger without really knowing what their background was. Therefore, I recommend to all my students that they not date somebody until the person has been checked out, so to speak, by someone that you trust. So if relatives know the person, can check a little bit into the background and see where he or she is coming from, that's a great thing. If friends know the person and can check a little bit into the background to see where the person's coming from, do that. Only after you've checked the person out carefully, then go out with them. By the way, besides being just a strategically smart move, this is a great way to show self-respect because you're too precious to be dating just any guy or girl that you haven't run into. So I recommend let somebody check the person out before you get involved. And I cannot tell you how much pain this could prevent. Another important piece of dating advice, and this is specifically for ladies. Ladies face a unique danger if they delay dating seriously, dating for marriage, until they have established themselves academically and professionally. And the danger is as follows. While a man's earning potential increases as he gets older, and his earning potential is one of the things that is attractive to women, a woman's sexual power starts to decline, meaning her ability to attract using that sexual power starts to decline, starting at age 30, 35, something like that. And if she waits until her career is fully established or she's gotten advanced academic degrees and it puts her up near that range, then she might end up getting edged out by younger women who the 35-year-old or 40-year-old men will be interested in. So, therefore, a woman really has to seriously consider dating some time before she gets into her 30s. It's dangerously late at that point. And unfortunately, there are a lot of women, especially in the last generation, who just never got married because the older men married much younger women who still had all that sexual power and attraction. Another important piece of dating advice, and again, I'm directing this specifically towards the ladies. Don't be so insistent on less important particulars so that you miss out on what's really important. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. It's crazy for a lady to insist that she won't date somebody unless they plan on living in California, because it could be that the perfect guy for her, a real sweetheart, just a wonderful human being, for professional reasons, has to live in D.C. I recommend to ladies that they should have a plan before they meet Mr. Right. But after they meet Mr. Right, that plan should be negotiable. That is, they should be willing to let go of small things like where they're going to live in order to get a guy with great character. I recommend this specifically to ladies because, unfortunately, in our generation, it is difficult, I will admit, to find a really high-quality guy. In many ways, in our generation, men have forgotten how to be men. They've forgotten how to take care of a woman, how to look out for her, how to protect her, how to show some chivalry. And because of that, women have to become more flexible. In order to get the guy who's a terrific guy, they might have to let go of some less significant details, and I recommend that strongly. I recognize that from a liberated perspective, it sounds a bit odd for us to be saying that the woman should have to compromise on these things. Why does the man have to compromise? Let him give up details of his career, where he's going to work, where he needs to live. But the reality is that in today's dating market, unfortunately, men do have the upper hand because they can date much younger women, and because there are more women, I think, with great values out there than men. And therefore, unfortunately, women are at a disadvantage in the dating market. And therefore, I recommend, with things that are not that important, women should learn to be very flexible. Most people have some just blindingly spectacular and beautiful externals, which they could flash and get a lot of attention. Very often, men will flash their academic degrees or their professional success. Man might flash a Rolex watch or a Montblanc pen, some indication of professional success, something like this. Women can flash all of those things. Women can also flash a little bit of body, and that can also blind men and attract them, draw them in. I'm going to make an odd recommendation. I recommend to my students that, as much as possible, they try not to be blinding in their revelation of their externals. And the reason is because it becomes very, very difficult for your partner to get to know you when you bring out these blindingly beautiful externals. The externals are also part of you, but there's also a real live human being inside. Behind the Mont Blanc pen or the great legs, there is a beautiful person who has dreams, has hopes, has fears, has deep emotions. And unfortunately, often, once we bring out the blinding externals, so it becomes very, very difficult to see past those to the more subtle interior aspects of personality. Let me give you some other examples of externals that, if flashed, can make a whole relationship very superficial. I have a friend who is one of the funniest men I have ever met. He's really just got an unbelievable sense of humor, and he can put me on the floor with my ribs aching in no time flat. But there are very few people who actually know him, because he's so funny that people focus on this external, this sense of humor, and they miss him. They consider him to be the funny guy, but he's much more than a funny guy. He's a fantastic human being. Very, very few people ever see that, though. There's a girl who I once counseled who, she happens to have been gifted with a brilliant mind. She literally had a photographic memory. She remembered as a child being able to look at a few pages from the encyclopedia, then hand the encyclopedia to somebody and read the encyclopedia back to them by heart. What a brilliant woman. So she confessed to me that she had a terrible time creating for herself some social life when she was in high school, because everyone related to her as the brain. And she had a lot of quote-unquote friends, people who liked to play with her intellect and watch it work, because she was a very entertaining person to play with. But very few people actually got to know her, her hopes, her dreams, her fears, her values, what she felt was important in life, what she wanted. Very few people ever got past her IQ to see who she really was. And of course, IQ is part of who you are. So is your earning ability and your legs. So is your sense of humor. But what I'm recommending is that we not bring these things out and display them so brightly that people can't see past them. I'm not recommending that a beautiful woman make herself ugly. God forbid! That's not what we're recommending. Every woman should present herself in a beautiful fashion, but there's a difference between beautiful and sexy. Unfortunately, that distinction is something which is lost on many people in this early 21st century. But the reality is that a person could be very, very, very beautiful without bringing out blinding sexuality. So too, a man who might be making $400,000, $500,000 a year, so if he flashes that, he'll make it very difficult for the other person to come to love him. He doesn't have to make himself look poor. God forbid, again. Your externals are part of you. So let him fake $200,000. That would be fine. No one's asking us to dress up in a sackcloth and pretend that we're poverty-stricken. But not to present such a bright, blinding external image that people can't actually get to know us. I'll tell you a story. I had a student who met a man who she was very attracted to, really, really wanted to marry. And after she'd been dating him for several months, she came to me and she told me that she intended on marrying this man. And I went behind her back. I knew who the fellow was. I went behind her back and I met with him privately. And I said to him, please, please don't tell. His parents are two of the wealthiest people on the planet. literally billionaires. And I wasn't worried at all that she would marry him for the money. No, not at all. I was worried the opposite, that she's such a good person that she would distrust herself and fear that maybe she really didn't see who he was and she was marrying him for the money and she would break off the relationship. So I said to him, please don't tell. He took my advice. And during the entire time they were dating, she had no idea that there were billions behind this man, that he never needed to work. His children would never need to work. His grandchildren would never need to work. He kept that under the blanket, so to speak. She told me that she suspected that something was going on when her mother-in-law showed up for the engagement party wearing a massive rock on her engagement ring. But she really didn't know that there was billions until after they were married. And that gave her the freedom to know that she was only marrying him for who he really was. If you have a great sense of humor, if you have a tremendous intellect, your career is crashing through the seventh heaven. So that's not something that you have to display in its full glory. And instead, you can talk to each other about what you would like in life, what you dream of, what makes you happy, what makes you sad, these sorts of things, and just have fun together. But not to flash the blinding externals early on in the process. You do want to be attractive. You do want to catch the eye of your potential partner. But you have to make sure that your presentation is not a lie. And you have to make sure that whatever you do in order to make your externals more attractive is not self-destructive. Unfortunately, because we're such a superficial culture, there are more and more people seeking potentially dangerous plastic surgeries every year. And doing so is dually destructive. One, it's always dangerous to go under a general anesthetic. It's always dangerous to go under the knife. And that is probably an extreme response to insecurity. And you don't need to do something that drastic. The breast enlargement surgeries, all these sorts of things that are being done, no one really knows what the side effects could be down the line. And we know there have been some terrible disasters, and it's just not worth it. So on the one hand, physically, you're putting yourself at risk. On the other hand, when you try to make yourself more attractive by using these drastic means, you do psychological damage to yourself because you drive home the message, you put into your heart a belief that you really aren't attractive without this external thing, whatever it is, that unless I pretend that I'm making $10 million a year, I'm really not worthwhile. And of course, that makes me feel bad about myself. If I feel that without a certain figure, I'm just not acceptable, and getting that figure would require surgery. So that sends a message right into my subconscious that essentially, inherently, I'm not an attractive person, and that's problematic. Now, of course, what kind of fluffing up, so to speak, do we encourage? So certainly, present yourself in a beautiful fashion. Not all ladies want to wear makeup, but if you want to wear makeup, wear makeup. Beautiful. Not all men dress in designer-cut clothing. But if you want to do such a thing, fine. That's not so radical. But to do something which is potentially destructive to yourself, physically or psychologically, it's common, I admit, but it's not healthy. The early stages in any process tend to have a huge effect on the way the process unravels down the line. And popping the question is really the beginning of getting married. So it's important that you do it right. One Orthodox Jew once pointed out to me that they believe that the first woman, Eve, was taken from Adam's rib. And in one passage in their traditional book, the Talmud, it says that because the woman came from the man, so the man pursues her to find this lost piece of himself. And from here they learn that it's important for a man to pursue a woman. Now, during the dating process, a woman should allow herself to be pursued. And she has to beware that if she pursues the man, because of men's natures, she risks scaring him away. When it comes time for popping the question, the man should pop the question, not the woman. And although she wants to get married, all she can really do is create an environment in which he will want to get married so badly that he will ask the question. Again, the risk is that if she pops the question, so to speak, if she says, you know, hey, let's get married, she could frighten him away. When he does pop the question, so it's important that he be a man about it. That is, he should say, I really want you to be my wife. Will you marry me? Or whatever language you would like to use. But it should be obvious to the woman that the decision is entirely in his hands. I've counseled people before where the marriage started off with him saying, I'd really like to marry you as long as my parents approve. And this is a tremendous turnoff to the woman. Even if it's true that because of whatever traditional values he possesses, he doesn't want to marry her until his parents approve, but that's not something that you say to the woman. It has to be that he gives her the impression that it's all in his hands, and he certainly shouldn't ask her to marry him until she's cleared whatever criteria need to be cleared in order for him to pop the question. The man and the woman need to be aware that at the time that he pops the question, it is a good time to discuss when the marriage will take place and come to a conclusion. Again, because there is so much panic about getting married, there's so much lack of commitment today, if you miss this valuable window of opportunity to set a date, the date might not get set. So when he says, will you marry me, he should say, will you marry me, maybe in November? And if he fails to specify, she should say, if she is interested, I do, I would love to marry you. When should we get married? When would be a good time? Maybe November? And they should start discussing the issue. Okay, now, the wedding. There's a couple of important things to know. One is, if her parents or his parents are paying for the wedding, or both parents are paying for the wedding, then the couple has to realize that the wedding is for the parents, not for the couple. And therefore, the couple should do whatever the parents want to do. She gets him and he gets her. Let the parents have the wedding. So I recommend to couples they be very, very easygoing, and whoever is paying for the wedding, let them make the determination. Now, of course, if only one side is paying for the wedding, either for traditional reasons or because the other side can't afford it, one still must be sensitive to the desires of the second side. And often here, children can play a role in helping their parents and their in-laws understand the needs of the other parent or the other in-law, meaning that he can express to his parents what her parents need, and she can express to her parents what his parents need. And in this way, both sets of parents will end up happy at the wedding, which is the goal. The wedding is for the parents if they're paying for it. Another piece of important advice. Today, it is tragically common that people will blow massive amounts of money on a wedding when later on down the line, they're really going to need that money to stay afloat, to stay financially above water. And it's a vicious cycle because since everybody else throws such expensive weddings, if we don't throw such an expensive wedding, then it doesn't look nice. But if the couple is creative and they're clever, they can find ways to drastically reduce costs. And it doesn't mean you can't invite a large party to the wedding. You can invite a very large group of people, but you don't need to have a long dessert table. You don't need necessarily to have a smorgasbord. There are very expensive aspects of the celebration that can be reduced, and no one will really care. Ironically, I found that those people who thought carefully and spent less on their wedding, they tended to have the most spectacular memories of their wedding, perhaps because they were focusing on other more important things. Another important thing to keep in mind at the wedding, under the marriage canopy, you have a captive audience. There are a large group of people sitting there usually who are listening to every word because it's a very special moment. And if there are ideals that the two of you are going to be building your marriage on, religious ideals, moral ideals, ethical ideals, that is a good time for the couple and or any clergy who are present to affirm those ideals, not only because it creates such a beautiful environment for the couple that they get to hear these ideals as they're launching their life together, but also because they get to share these ideals with their friends and family who are sitting there together. And really, a wedding without some sort of deep content always seems shallow. Great marriages don't just happen. There's a Western romantic lie that if you just meet the right person, then you'll have a great marriage without making any effort. And that's just not true. All the people who I know have successful marriages, they put more energy into their marriage than any other single project in their lives. That means more energy, more time, more money. In every way, that is their top priority, and that makes a great marriage. If you're looking for the person you can marry, who, once you marry them, you'll just have a great marriage without effort, you're going to be waiting a long time. So what sorts of things do we have to do to ensure that, in fact, our marriage becomes and remains a great marriage? We'll start off with a topic which is not often discussed in public, certainly not in most courses that we take in university or in high school on relationships. Every really good marriage has two parallel themes. On the one hand, the couple is aggressively pursuing intimacy, a closeness together, a sharing, an openness. Intimacy flourishes best in a playful environment, an environment which is not too heavy or too serious. And therefore, the couple has to be careful not to become so formal with each other that they can't play laugh and joke. That most people realize. What most people don't realize, what many people forget, is that as aggressively as a couple pursues intimacy in their relationship, they also have to pursue respect. That is, before one can fall in love, one has to fall in respect. One has to feel that the person that they're facing, the one who's going to be their life partner, is an awesome human being. Now, I've heard people object before, but my partner is not an awesome human being. The truth is, though, that the only people I've ever met who I'm not, pardon the vernacular, blown away by, the only people I've met who I'm not tremendously impressed with are those people I don't know well. But if somebody has spent 20, 30 years of their life doing something, learning about the world, picking a way of life, there are things inside of them that are astounding. And in order to have a great marriage, I must find out what is so astounding about my partner. Beyond that, when I pursue these things and I find out what is astounding about them, on my own I have to review them constantly so that I fall in awe. When I first met my wife, it was in a professional academic environment. And because of the nature of the environment, there was no room for any sort of romantic attachment. It was completely inappropriate. And we were together on an academic seminar. And during the entire period of the academic seminar, we related to each other as colleagues. Now, I admit I was very attracted to her, but for professional reasons, we had to relate as colleagues. When the seminar ended and I approached her to ask her if she wanted to date, wanted to go out with me, I had difficulty slipping out of this professional respect that I had developed during the period of the seminar. And when we first dated, we continued to date as colleagues, so to speak, discussing our thoughts, our dreams, our values. The entire first week that I dated her, I did not hold her hand. And then the second week, I also didn't touch her. For an entire month, I dated this woman without ever having physical contact with her, which was not typical of me or any of my other college friends. But because I had met this woman in this academic environment first, in this professional environment, that was the step that our relationship was launched on. It began with tremendous respect, and I felt it would be like degrading to her if I made a pass, so to speak. What ended up happening was that throughout our dating, the physical aspects of the relationship were minimized, the intimacy was minimized, and all of the emphasis was put on falling in awe with each other. And then when someone takes that path and they get married, and the intimacy is added into the formula, it creates an explosion. Then the intimacy is far beyond the sort of experience that one could have if one launches right into the intimacy without first developing respect. So in our marriages, it's important that we keep asking ourselves what is awesome about our partner and that we review that information often. Another important piece of advice: I don't know if there's ever been a generation that has been so challenged by distractions. For example, technology really gets in the way of many of the most intimate moments in life. It used to be, in the old days, that a woman might have to fight the newspaper for her husband's attention. But today, men and women have to fight not only the television, but the internet. for the attention of their spouse. Cell phones follow us every place into the most intimate moments of our lives. If I was speaking with you, and in the middle of a conversation, somebody walked up and interrupted us and started speaking to me, I would say to them, excuse me, I'm talking to another person right now. I can't speak with you. Just a minute, please. But it's interesting, if I'm speaking to you, and in the middle of that, my cell phone rings, I'll tell you, you have to wait, and I'll answer my cell phone. Why is it that the bell has such priority that it gets to break in on my most intimate moments in the middle of a conversation with somebody else? I had a friend who went down to South Africa during the period of apartheid, and he was eating at someone's home, and when they finished the first course, in order to call the servants to come and clear the table and bring the second course, the master of the home picked up a bell and rang a bell, and that called the servants in. And my friend said he found it revolting that you should call a human being with a bell. That's disgusting. When he left South Africa, I came back to his apartment in New York, arrived at his apartment, put his bags down, wanted to take a shower, hopped in the shower. While he was in the shower, the phone rang. He hopped out of the shower, naked, went running across the room towards the bell, and about halfway across the room realized that he was acting exactly like those slaves in South Africa. We can be enslaved to technology, and it can come to dominate our lives and get in the way of what's really important to us, which is being close to others. Beyond technology, cell phones, pagers, television sets, computers, all these sorts of things, beyond these things which can get in the way, there are other things which sometimes come between two people who really want to love each other. For example, food. How many times have you been at a table and there's a great conversation going on and the food is served and suddenly the table goes silent and both people fall into their plates, devour their food. 15 minutes later, they come up for air and have a discussion again. You have to remember that the whole purpose of the food was to create a pleasant environment for the conversation. That was the goal. Sometimes we are so obsessed, so distracted by the chocolate chip cookies that we fail to notice the loving spouse who made them for us. And there's a deeper way that food sometimes distracts, and this is a pathology that I've been seeing more and more often. Often people who don't want closeness, who actually have fear of commitment and fear of intimacy, so they'll use food to even physically distance themselves from others to prevent intimacy. I've seen people who, they overeat because they know that with an extra 6 or 8 or 10 inches of fat on their body, they don't have to worry that someone will get close to them. So we have to be concerned with things like food. Are they coming between us and those that we love? Here's one below the belt, so to speak. Something that really gets in the way of relationships, a real distraction, and one that unfortunately we're almost all guilty of, is schedule. Scheduling ourselves so tightly that we have no time to create intimacy in our lives. I mean, it's not all our fault. We've been trained that productivity is the measure of success in life. How much money you make, how many papers you've written. And it takes a little bit of reprogramming to realize that that's ultimately not the measure of the man or the woman. The real measure of a human being is how much intimacy and respect they've created in their lives. How much of a connection to their significant others. And creating that sort of intimacy, that sort of respect, that takes time. These Orthodox Jews, they have a law that they follow, a marriage law, that minimally, twice a week, the couple has to spend private time alone. Minimally. It's something that we could learn from their culture, is that we cannot expect to have intimacy in our lives if we can't schedule our spouses into our daily routines. And let's not fool ourselves. If we don't schedule it, it's not going to happen. I'm not recommending that you get rid of your cell phone. The truth is that a cell phone is a very powerful way to remain connected as long as you can control the cell phone and not let the cell phone control you. The rule I give to my students is, if you can turn your cell phone off for a few hours a day, then you have a right to turn it on. But if you can't ever turn it off, if it's going to interrupt every conversation, then you can't turn it on. Same is true by the internet. These Orthodox Jews observe a Sabbath once a week, a 25-hour withdrawal from the world of physical creativity and technology. The Sabbath arrives punctually every Friday afternoon, leaves 25 hours later on Saturday night, and during this period, Orthodox Jews do not use computer or telephone or any other technology like that. Rather, they focus on what's really important in life, on each other. So we could learn from them to Friday afternoon, shut down the computer. It's hard. It's not easy. There's always a little bit more work to do. There's always one more article to read. And it takes might. And we haven't been trained to be a mighty generation. We've been trained to be efficient and quick. But if you're not mighty, then you can't fight back those forces which would come between you and the one that you love. And then you might end up missing out on intimacy. So we've got to learn to shut off the technology just like we learn to turn it on. To use it when it's appropriate and shut it off when it's not. We've got to learn to use food for the sake of connecting to others, not as a distraction. And we've got to learn to take control of our schedules and not let our schedules control us. The schedule in times when we can become close to others. I'll give you a metaphor which illustrates this concept very nicely. If you have two surfaces that you want to make absolute, perfect, and total contact, you want these surfaces to become like one. You have to make sure that there's no dust or dirt on the surface. You've got to remove all the dirt from the surface. And when the surfaces are surgically sterile, then if you put them together, they will have total contact. The same is true about man and woman. It's important that there not be any dirt on the surface, so to speak, distractions that can come between us. Because when those distractions exist, it's very, very difficult to connect. The word that these very traditional Jews use for the first step towards getting married is kiddushin. Kiddushin, most people translate as holiness. There is this stage of holiness that the couple enters into, after which they complete the marriage and actually are married. What is this state of holiness? So their primary text, the Talmud, explains that this initial state that one goes into to get married is a state in which all other suitors, anyone else who the couple previously dated, is removed from the relationship. That is, I am no longer going to think about that other person. I'm only going to think about you. That's called kedushin or holiness. That's removing the dirt that could come between us. All the ex-boyfriends, all the ex-girlfriends, and the cell phones, and the scheduling problems. Anything that could come between us, we move out of the way so that we can focus on each other. We all know that men and women are different. We're always just shocked to find out how far beyond obvious physical differences the difference between men and women goes. And of course, these differences are most evident in our heterosexual relationships. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. These traditional Jews believe that the way that you get close to another person, the essential organ of intimacy in a human being, is the mouth. And while it's true that when someone speaks to me, I get to know them, I get to like them, the traditional Jewish perspective is that it's when you speak to somebody else that you create true intimacy. That is, the more that you speak to somebody, the more close you feel to that person. Now, what's interesting here is the difference between men and women. Traditional Jews speak about a male style of speech and a female style of speech. And while it's true that men do sometimes engage in female speech and women do sometimes engage in male speech, women are dominant when it comes to female speech and men are dominant when it comes to male speech. What is the difference? The difference is female speech is essentially about relationship and male speech is essentially about productivity. Sometimes a woman will be speaking to a man, and she's talking to him, and she's telling him about an idea that she has or a feeling that she has, and she's communicating with him, giving over herself to him. And she might speak to him for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and he will just sit there nodding. And then after 20, 30 minutes, she'll say, you know, what do you think? And he says to her, yeah, I agree. Silence. At which point she'll then, again, speak to him for 10, 15, 20 minutes, and then say, you know, what do you think? And he'll say, yeah, sounds good. And after enough of this, the woman will grab him by the collar and shake him and say, talk to me! What's going on? Men are more inclined towards male speech, which is productive speech. Male speech is could you please pass the ketchup? No, I'll take out the trash. Hey, who's paying the water bill? That's all male speech. It gets things done. Female speech is very different. In female speech, there is not necessarily any purpose other than drawing close to the one that you're speaking to. Sometimes you'll see two women walking down the street, and they're both talking simultaneously. And that's not because they're not caring about each other. The opposite is true. the essential purpose of the conversation was far beyond the mundane communication of needs or instructions. Rather, the reason they're talking to each other is to draw close. So men are often hesitant to speak unless something specifically needs to be said to accomplish something functional. Women, on the other hand, will speak even if there's nothing that needs to be said. And the reason is because they're sensitive to the higher power of speech. Women possess a sensitivity here that men lack, and that is that we draw close by speaking to another. This presents a challenge to men. Men have to learn to open up and communicate their feelings, their thoughts, to their spouse, to their wife. And it's not always comfortable at the beginning for men to do such a thing. But it's crucial, not to satisfying his wife. It's crucial for his own intimate life. In order for him to actually draw close to his wife, he has to learn to open up to her. Women, on the other hand, have to be aware that men will have difficulty in opening up, in speaking in feminine language, that is, in speaking just for the sake of creating a relationship. Women have another skill, though, which can help them overcome a man who is hesitant to speak. And that is, women have this amazing intuition. These traditional Jews call it a bina. Bina is an ability which these traditional Jews say women have more of, an ability to detect myriad subtle pieces of data and draw accurate conclusions even without hearing explicit statements from the person they're conversing with. It's common that, for instance, a woman will know exactly what's going on with her husband without him saying a word. And she has that skill because otherwise it would be very difficult for her to know what's going on inside of her husband because men are so hesitant to speak. Once again, though, even though most women can read their husbands without verbal communication, it's very important for the man to learn to communicate verbally, not so that his wife knows what's going on with him, but so that he can experience the intimacy that only comes by speaking to another. Beyond these concepts of dual themes, respect and intimacy, and beyond this idea of removing distractions, there is another important piece of advice that makes a good marriage, and that is, we've got to learn to sweat the small things. I'll explain what I mean and how I tripped upon this idea. These traditional Jews follow a very detailed legal code, which makes recommendations for almost every aspect of their life. And many of the laws are extremely detailed that they follow. The Sabbath could come in on any particular week at 5:42 and 18 seconds. It might leave at 6:27 and 38 seconds. What a crazy amount of detail. They've got to give minimally exactly 10% of their net after taxes to charity, but not more than 20%. And the more that you look over the laws that these people live by, you see they're so picayune, they're so detailed. And I remember once asking one of their sages, like, does God really care? Like, these details are what he's into? Whatever happened to just being a good person? And this sage explained to me that all of Judaism is about making a person into someone who will be successful at relationships. And all relationships rise or fall based on the little details. I didn't understand, and he explained further. The more that you love somebody, the more you're interested in discovering the details that make them happy. In my counseling practice, I've seen a lot of couples who are contemplating divorce. I have not yet met a couple who was getting divorced over a major theme. He's a Republican! I'm a Democrat! I want a divorce! I never saw such a thing. I never heard about a couple who the woman said, I want a divorce! He forgot my 25th anniversary! I'm out of here! It's never based on something major like that. What is it usually based on? I kid you not. It's usually based on something like, I can't stand it. She never puts the cap back on the toothpaste. I had a woman who swore to me that her husband didn't love her. I said, how do you know? What makes you think he doesn't love you? She explained to me, when he uses the toilet at night, he always forgets to put the lid down. I go in there at night, I fall right in. I said, well, you must be kidding. Based on that, you're going to divorce the man? A fellow came to me. He wanted to divorce his wife. I said, why? He'd start to grow a beard. And he said to me, she doesn't like the beard. She won't let me grow the beard. I'm going to divorce her. I said, give me a knife. I'll cut the beard or your throat. What, are you crazy? It's a great lady. You're going to divorce her because of the beard? It turns out that if I really, really care about somebody, I'll sweat the small things. And more than that, the more that I sweat the small things, the more I actually learn to care about the person. Every now and then, a couple will come to me, and their marriage is doing fine. And I'll ask them, your marriage is doing fine. What are you here for? And they say, we just came for some pointers. At which point I'll say, listen, your marriage is doing fine. Maybe you give me some pointers. Tell me, why is your marriage doing so great? How do you know that she really loves you? And the guy will turn to me and he'll say, I know. How do you know? And he'll say, I know. How do you know? He says, I'll give you an example. When I come home at night and I unlock the front door and walk in, and she looks up and she sees that it's me, this big smile always spreads on her face. I said to him, that's it? He says, she loves me. Oh, look at the smile. She looks at me, she smiles. Another man once told me he knows that his wife loves him because whenever he comes home from work, she has a hot cup of tea waiting for him. She sweats the small things. I asked a woman once, she said her husband loved her very much. I said, how do you know? She says, what do you mean, how do I know? Sometimes when he leaves for work, he leaves me a note. And then she started to giggle. And I said, so what? She said, on the note, there's only three words. And she giggled again. If you leave a note for your spouse that says, I love you, it's a small thing. But that's the kind of thing that makes a relationship go. If you really care about somebody, you'll notice the small things that make them happy. And if you really want to care about somebody, practice noticing the small things. And that'll draw you into real intimacy.